Welcome to the Instructional Leadership Show. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and this is episode 50, the Instructional Leadership Show, which we're calling Closing Gaps in Your Instructional Framework. And I thought this would be an appropriate topic as we start to think about resuming some of the conversations with staff around practice and starting to identify where there might be gaps in our shared expectations in our instructional frameworks based on those conversations that we're having with staff. Every week, our focus on the Instructional Leadership Show is helping you confidently get into classrooms every day, have feedback conversations that change teacher practice, and discover your best opportunities for school improvement. And every month on the show, we focus on a different theme, and we cycle through these six themes: productivity, walkthroughs, conversations, and so on. And for the month of March 2020, we're focused on feedback conversations. And next month, for April, we'll be shifting into a focus on instructional frameworks that can help us get aligned and specific. So this episode is kind of a bridge between those two themes of feedback conversations and the shared expectations that we are using to kind of anchor our conversations and align them in shared expectations. So our essential question for today is, how can we use conversations about practice to identify gaps in our shared expectations? And then how can we close those gaps with instructional frameworks, either by pulling in expectations that may already be out there or developing our own? See, the problem is not that we don't have shared expectations. Often we have lots of shared expectations, or we have lots of expectations that we try to share, and you know, maybe to differing degrees of success, but often those expectations are not specific enough. We want people to do something, we want people to use a certain practice, but often the level of specificity that we've given people so far doesn't really go beyond the buzzword. And I believe if we are going to truly benefit from shared expectations, we've got to make sure those expectations are clear and specific enough so that people know what to do, and so that those expectations create a pathway for growth. So what are we talking about with shared expectations? Where do we get these shared expectations for teacher practice? Of course, one major source of those shared expectations is your existing teacher evaluation criteria. So you have some sort of written expectations for what teacher practice looks like, and those, of course, should serve as much of the basis for your feedback conversations. They serve as the vocabulary, the evaluation rubric that you use plays into your feedback conversations. Even if an individual conversation is not evaluative, you're using the language from that evaluation document to have that conversation. It serves as your vocabulary. You also have shared expectations based on practices that you've adopted school-wide. For example, when I was a middle school science teacher, my school was an AVID school. So we used the AVID strategies like SLANT and Cornell Notes and all the strategies that we'd been trained on. You might have other trainings that have provided specific strategies for different departments, or you might have curriculum that has provided specific practices that teachers use. For example, when I was an elementary principal, we adopted the Lucy Calkins Writer's Workshop model. And of course, there are specific practices embedded with that. You have students sit on the rug, you make anchor charts, you do mini lessons, and so on. So there are lots of different sources of shared expectations. And what we're going to talk about today is finding opportunities to close gaps in those expectations, you know, where we want a certain thing to happen, but we realize in the course of talking with teachers about their practice of getting into classrooms and having feedback conversations that there's not enough specificity in certain areas. And you're going to find that over and over again. And what I want to challenge you to do is take that level of specificity from simply a buzzword to the level of a procedure, all the way up to the level of a rubric. We want that degree of specificity that says, this is what it looks like, this is what the different levels of performance look like for this practice. For example, I mentioned Lucy Calkins' Writer's Workshop, and one of the big instructional methods at the heart of Writer's Workshop is teaching a brief mini lesson, not teaching the entire subject as one giant lesson, but teaching a brief mini lesson and then having students go and write and conferring with them individually. But that mini lesson became a big point of focus because it's hard to make your lessons mini if you're not used to doing that, right? Keeping the lesson short, just 10 minutes, having a clear teaching point, making an anchor chart, you know, calling on students in a very purposeful way that doesn't just become this open-ended sharing time that goes on and on for 30 minutes and doesn't teach anything. No, it needed to be very, very specific. And in the course of developing a collective understanding of what mini lessons looked like, we went from simply the buzzword mini lesson. You know, we realize mini lessons aren't magical. They have to happen a certain way in order to have the impact. So we can't just say, from now on, everybody, we're doing mini lessons. The buzzword is not enough. Then we went on to the level of specificity of a procedure. Here's how you do a mini lesson. First, you do this, then you do that. Let's demonstrate it, let's model it, let's practice it. But beyond the procedural level, beyond just going through the steps, there's a deeper level that we can describe with rubrics. And when you get into really good teacher's classroom, you know, somebody who's very proficient, who's very advanced with a particular practice, you can start to identify the deeper differences between what a less experienced and less skilled person is doing and what those true experts are doing. And that's how you can start to develop those rubrics. So what do we want to focus on? You know, I don't know what the biggest focus should be for your school, but you've probably heard me say this before, that you want to develop shared expectations around practices that are high frequency. You know, they're happening every day. It's not, you know, once a semester we do this, but this is something that's happening all the time. So it has a lot of opportunity to make a difference for kids. The practice itself is significant to learning, right? You know, maybe there are some things that could be just time savers, but probably you're going to focus on things that are instructionally, really at the heart of teaching and learning. So they're high impact. And third, you're probably going to want to focus on things that vary a lot in terms of quality. Some people do them really well, some people do them really poorly, and you want to bring everybody up to a shared standard of excellence. So high frequency, high impact, and high variability. Those are the kinds of practices that you want to look for and develop shared expectations around so that, you know, we're not just holding certain people up on a pedestal as models and saying, why can't you be more like Mrs. Smith over here? We're describing Mrs. Smith's practice with a rubric that says, okay, this is level 4 in this particular area. And we're describing the other levels so that people can see the path to growth. So if somebody realizes, oh, I'm actually a level 2 in this practice, they have a path forward. They know what they can do by following that roadmap. So those are some kind of guidelines on how we can find promising practices. Another way that you can identify something that, you know, an area where you might need to be more specific is to do what I call following the buzz. If you hear the buzz of a bee, you know, if you follow that bee long enough, you know, it's springtime right now, you might see bees. We've got bees in our yard right now. You know, if you follow a bee long enough, it will go back to its hive. And, you know, you can end up where you want to be by following that buzz. And when it comes to shared expectations, often following a buzzword back to its origin, back to its reference point, back to what it originally came from, can be an incredibly powerful way to increase alignment and fidelity and get your shared expectations much more clearly articulated. For example, I was in an online discussion, I think this is in a principal Facebook group, a couple of weeks ago, where principals were talking about PBIS, and someone said, you know, what do you use for PBIS rewards? And a lot of people had a lot of answers about PBIS rewards, but other people said, you know, I'm not really sure that the rewards are really the main thing when it comes to PBIS. Like, where's all this reward stuff coming from? And I went back to what my original source, my kind of beehive for PBIS had been, and there was a Department of Education website, there were some trainings and conferences, and I went and looked at those original source materials. I went back to the queen bee, went back to the hive there, and I found that, yeah, there's very little about rewards, and rewards were kind of like a tier 2 or tier 3 intervention to help specific students solve specific problems with their behavior. So this whole idea that PBIS is all about rewards and a store and prizes and coupons and things like that really wasn't there when I followed that buzzword back to its source. And I think we've got to do that anytime that we find ourselves repeating a buzzword over and over again. Oh yes, we're doing mini lessons. We're doing mini lessons, or we're doing Avid, we're doing Slant. You know, whatever it is that you are trying to help people get better at in your school, if you hear yourself saying those buzzwords, or you hear other people using those buzzwords, I want to encourage you to follow that buzz. Follow that back to the source and find out what's there and get more specific. Because when you get more specific, you really can have feedback conversations that change teacher practice. What you want to find out as you seek that source, as you seek that beehive, is you want to find out what that practice looks like from the inside. And we have a concept at the Principal Center that I call observability bias that I think we need to be very careful about. Observability bias is our tendency as instructional leaders to want look-fors. We want look-fors, I've got my air quotes here, that make it easy for us as outside observers to go into a classroom and see a practice. We want it to be just super clear to us in just a few seconds that we're seeing what we should be seeing. And I understand the desire there. I understand the desire to have clarity and alignment, but I think we've got to be careful when it comes to look-fors. I think we've got to be careful about observability bias, because if we're not careful, what we will end up with is shallow oversimplifications of practice. If you go into your best teacher's classroom and observe and pay attention and really try to get a sense of what they're doing, you will start to realize that a lot of teaching is about decision-making. It's not just the observable behaviors, it's the decision-making that's going on up here in the teacher's head that tells you, or that really makes the difference for student learning. And if you want to change teacher practice, it's not enough, my friends, to only focus on the observable behaviors. So hone in on the decisions that the teacher is making and start to flesh out for yourself, what are the key dimensions of this practice from the insider's perspective? And only once you've done that can you start to identify differences in levels of performance. So observability bias is related to a concept that we call the iceberg. We look at teacher practice or model teacher practice like an iceberg, where there are some aspects of teaching that are above the surface, just as there is some portion of an iceberg that floats above the surface. But in the same way, as 90% of an iceberg is below the surface, just the tip is, you know, sticking up above the surface. We're only seeing a tiny bit when we look at an iceberg. You've really got to get under the level of the water to see the other 90%. It's the same with teacher practice. When we go in with that observability bias in mind, we, you know, we've got our list of look-fors. I want to see what it looks like. I want to see a good mini lesson. Well, a good mini lesson could be videoed, but I don't want my students to just watch videos or to get video quality instruction. I want my students to benefit from instruction that is guided by sound teacher decision-making. In order to really advance that kind of teaching, we have to go beneath the surface and we have to empathize and understand the decisions that teachers are making instructionally. And we've got to approach our observations with a degree of humility that says, you know what, I'm not going to just be able to see everything that's going on in this lesson. And on the horizontal axis of our diagram here, you can see we've got the concept of zoom. Some of teacher practice is going to play out over a very brief period of time. It's highly observable. It's what we call a short or a tight zoom, so that in just a few minutes, you can see that aspect of practice. For example, in a mini lesson, I could see how the teacher calls on students and responds to them based on what they say. It's a tight zoom. It happens in just a few minutes. What I can't see, because it has too long of a zoom, is teacher planning. I didn't see the planning that went into this lesson, most likely. I didn't see the relationships that the teacher has built with students and families. I didn't see the teaching of expectations for how students act during mini lessons that happened way back in September. I didn't see those practices or those aspects of practice, even though they're relevant right now, because the Zoom is too long. So we've got to be mindful of the key dimensions of a practice and whether they're actually going to be visible to us. And we have to be okay with some of them not being visible to us. If we really want to understand teacher practice, if we really want to align our expectations for teaching and learning, we've got to accept the reality that not everything is going to be easy for us to observe. So how can we really get a sense of what's going on and what needs to be in those shared expectations? One place you can look for opportunities is in multiple teachers' classrooms who teach either the same grade level, the same subject, the same course, back to back. And I happened to do this as a principal simply because my building was laid out this way. You know, the third grade team is on that hallway, and then the fourth grade team is at the end of the hallway, and the second grade team is right downstairs, you know, all at the end of the hall. Like, just campus-wise, the layout of our campus clustered teachers together. And if people moved grade levels, they would move classrooms in order to be close geographically within the building to their teams. And what that allowed me to do was to visit teachers back to back when they were teaching roughly the same subject. Now, in my first year as principal there, we didn't have a schedule that gave every teacher within a grade level the same schedule. They had a different prep period that, you know, somebody would have a different prep period on Thursdays and they would have to find a time to meet because they didn't have the same schedule every day. So one of the first things I did moving from my first year into my second year, one of the biggest changes I made was to the schedule and to the way we did PE and art and library and music so that every teacher could have a common planning period with their grade level team. And what that allowed me to do was walk into one classroom and see part of a math lesson, and walk into the next classroom, same grade level, and see the same math lesson, and walk into the next classroom and see maybe a different part of the lesson, but the same lesson. And what that allowed me to do was get a sense of the internal logic of the curriculum. So my next recommendation is that you go deep on your curriculum. Don't be afraid to dig in to your curriculum, because the curriculum is going to be one of your best resources for identifying fruitful areas for developing shared expectations. So again, next month, we are focusing more on instructional frameworks. And as you get into classrooms, you know, whenever that may be, I know you may be out of school right now, a lot of people are on spring break, and we're filming this during the coronavirus pandemic when a lot of schools in a lot of places are closed. But whenever this becomes relevant for you, whenever you're able to get back into classrooms and have feedback conversations with teachers, I want to encourage you to not be afraid of curriculum, to go deep on curriculum, to dig into it, to get an extra copy of the teacher's guide. Often your district will be happy to give you one, or you can order one for not too much money, or you can just borrow one for a minute and take a look at it and strive to understand the internal logic of the curriculum. This is something that, in my experience, instructional leaders tend to be a little bit afraid of, because it puts us in a non-expert role. Right? Like, I was a science teacher, I was not a math teacher, I was not a language arts teacher. So if I was going to dig into the math curriculum, I was going to do so as something of a novice. I have not taught math for a day in my life. And I think that can be a little bit threatening for us as leaders to say, you know what, I'm not an expert on this, but I'm committed to learning. I want to sit alongside you and learn what good instruction looks like with this math curriculum. We've got to do that to be effective instructional leaders. Do you agree? Let me know what you think. If you're watching this on social media, leave a comment. Let me know what you think, whether you're watching this live or later. Do you agree with me that we need to become experts in our curriculum? I think we do. I think we have got to understand our curriculum in order to have intelligent conversations about teacher practice, about the key practices and those shared expectations that we develop around those practices, without falling victim to observability bias, without reducing the complex decision-making that teachers are doing to just whatever's easiest for us to observe. I don't know what you think about that, but that's where I stand on this issue. We've got to dig deep. We've got to get into that curriculum and see what teacher practice really is all about, the way that that curriculum is designed. And when you dig deep, here's the thing that can happen when you dig deep into your curriculum. Sometimes you dig deep and you hit a rock and you think, oh, there's not really much here. This is a pretty thin curriculum when it comes to pedagogy. And I remember a time in the kind of the evolution of the math curriculum in my district when we wanted students to have more computational fluency in one area because we had a very strong conceptual curriculum, but computational fluency wise, it wasn't there. And we looked at the computational fluency supplemental materials and we thought, okay, these are great for getting kids proficient with their practice, their multiplication facts and so on. But conceptually, there's not much here. Pedagogically, there's not much here. So we realized the big difference between those two curricula. If we were going to fruitfully focus on shared expectations for pedagogy in math, it was not going to be this little supplemental curriculum that we were using over here. It had to be the big, substantial curriculum. So go deep. Know when you're hitting bottom with that, when you're kind of running out, when you're scraping the bottom of the barrel, and there's just not more pedagogy to guide you and to give you those shared expectations that can create a roadmap for growth. That's the point when you can add on something else and say, you know what? We attended this conference a couple years ago and we learned about this practice that I think would really deepen our practice in this area where our curriculum just doesn't give us much to go on, right? Like we've got the materials, we've got the activities, we've got the scope and sequence, but pedagogy-wise, practice-wise, we need more. If you are going to add on more, which often you will want to, you at least need to know what you're adding on to. And if you don't, what you will find, I found this out personally time and time again, often there will be conflicts between the core curriculum and its pedagogical assumptions and what you're trying to add on to it. For example, one big philosophical kind of conflict within math curriculum is some math curriculum teaches in a spiral where most concepts are not taught to mastery, and other math curriculum teaches every concept to mastery every time. You can't do both of those at once. They are different approaches. So if you're going to add additional pedagogy, additional expectations onto your curriculum, at least know what you're adding on to. And to do that, don't be afraid of curriculum. Okay, sidebar over there. But I hope this has been helpful in thinking about where you might want to develop stronger and clearer shared expectations based on what you're learning from your feedback conversations. And ultimately, I hope that you hand this work over to teachers. Not hand it over completely and like wash your hands of it. Do wash your hands, but don't wash your hands of shared expectations. We have a program called the Instructional Framework Development Program. And if you're a member of the Instructional Leadership Association, you'll find that in your dashboard, or if you need a link, let me know and we can send that to you. The idea here is that when teachers sit down and say, okay, what is this practice really about? What are we doing when we're using this practice? They can identify the different dimensions and the different levels of performance within each of those dimensions so that when you go into a classroom, you know what's going on in the teacher's head. You know what decisions they are making, and you're not basing your feedback simply on what's easiest for you to notice. In other words, you can save yourself from observability bias when you get teachers to work together to develop instructional frameworks. So if you are part of our Instructional Vision Project, I'll be talking to some of my colleagues in Seattle tomorrow about this, about working on your instructional vision, identifying areas where your school would benefit from clearer shared expectations for teacher practice. And again, we want to go not just to the buzzword level of specificity, not just to the step-by-step procedure level of specificity, but to the rubric level of specificity, so that when we're talking about practice, we're not only using shared vocabulary, we're using leveled language. We're using, kind of Danielson quality shared expectations to really get ourselves on the same page. And when someone has an opportunity for growth, we're seeing, oh, this person really could get stronger in this area. We're not the ones trying to kind of badger them to go to that next level. They can see it because it's there in writing. And if it's in writing because teachers work together to develop that expectation themselves, even better. So if you are a navigator school and you want to talk about this, I'm talking with one of our navigator schools tomorrow, please reach out. Please let me know if you would like to work together on this, and I will share with you the instructional framework development program that goes along with this. There is an administrator side as well that we call the instructional framework Institute, and I'll get you the training sessions for that, and we can talk about how to roll this out in your school. I'm excited about this because I'm working with about a dozen schools right now, and I think about this time next year, this is going to be my next book to share how schools are using shared expectations in the form of leveled rubrics to get themselves on the same page and to create a pathway for growth for teachers. So again, if you're interested in that, please reach out and let me know. One more thing I want to mention that you can do with this leveled language that you developed, and we'll talk about this throughout the month of April, is you can import that language into repertoire so that when you're typing your notes, you're taking notes in the classroom, it's at your fingertips. By default, we typically recommend importing your teacher evaluation language, but it's so powerful when teachers have written their own language, their own rubrics for practice, that you can actually import those as well. We can import them for you. Just send us a Word document or whatever, and we'll get that imported for you if you are a repertoire user. And I think that is going to be it for today. Again, please reach out if you're a Navigator school, you're interested in the Vision Project, or if you are interested in becoming a Navigator organization. I'm in talks with I know a number of schools that are looking into that organizational membership, and then kind of had to put a pause on decision making because schools closed for a while. But if we were talking about that, if you're interested in that, you can learn more about how I work with superintendents, central office leaders, principal evaluators at principalcenter.com/roundtable. That's it for this episode of the Instructional Leadership Show. This has been episode 50, Closing Gaps in Your Instructional Framework. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you next time. Thanks so much for tuning in.